This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Have you used one of those new home diagnostic tests, a test that your doctor might have done in her office, but you can now order online and do at home? It is a growing industry for those curious to know more about their current testosterone or their glucose levels, for example. You can now order a blood test from a company like Inside Tracker to get that information. But without a doctor, how do you interpret the data? How useful is it really? Sure, the internet has helped put consumers directly in touch with the products they want without having to go to a retail store to buy them. It makes things cheaper, more affordable by cutting out that middleman. But what if that middleman is your doctor? Is that a risky thing to do? My next guest wanted to find out, so he ordered the Inside Tracker test for himself and made changes to his diet and fitness routine based on that information. And he discovered that owning your own data isn't as empowering as it appears to be. Peter Andre Smith is a science writer and contributor to Outside Magazine, where he wrote about his experience using the Inside Tracker blood test. And joining him is Shannon Heyman, associate professor of pathology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Our number 844-724-8255. Peter, see, you wrote about this company, Inside Tracker, which offers a direct-to-consumer blood test. Tell us what your experience was.
Yeah, well, one afternoon I was just sitting at my desk and my editor gave me a call and said, hey, do you want to try out this new thing? And I said, sure, let's look into it. And so I found out what companies offered the service in New York. There's only a couple. And I ordered the test and a nurse came to my apartment, drew my blood. And 2 days later, I had results.
And what were the results? I don't, you don't have to share what they were, well, but I mean, did you know what to do? What kinds of tests did you take?
So they have like a suite of tests.
Right.
So it's like a number of blood biomarkers, things that are biological indicators of your health. And the stuff like glucose, vitamin D, testosterone. I mean, there's a whole list of them. And so, I mean, I feel like I'm a fairly healthy person, and the test sort of reflected that I'm a fairly healthy person. There weren't any big surprises.
So you know how to interpret the results that came back.
Well, I mean, they sort of help you. They can say this isn't within the range of what we expect someone of your age mm-hmm. and of your activity level to be. Mm-hmm. So they're pretty helpful in sort of interpreting the data for you as well. And they make it clear that it's not medical advice. This is just, you know, tools for you to get healthier, essentially.
Yeah. It's sort of like the labels they put on the commercials for taking additives. Has not been evaluated.
Right, right. There's a little asterisk next to these tasks, yes.
Dr. Heyman, you're someone who is very familiar with medical tests. Was it a surprise to you when companies started offering blood tests direct to consumers?
I don't think so. It's interesting. With everyone having mobile technologies that allow us to do and take control of all of the other things in our lives, why wouldn't this follow? And there was a lot of news of companies doing this, one of them most notably Theranos, and laws changing to enable people to do this. So we've been watching it slowly happening, and it's clear that it's here now.
But there should be some kinds of tests that you can allow yourself to do. I mean, people who are diabetic, they draw their own blood, a little pinprick of blood, and take a glucose test. Why can't I do that with my cholesterol, which gives me a number that's useful, or something like that? Do you have any problem with that?
Well, so that's right. You can go to a number of stores today and buy things like pregnancy tests. Urine drug tests, for example. There are people, as you say, measuring their blood glucose who probably know much more about that and are an expert in that, probably more than I am, for their own personal numbers every day. But there are other tests that I think should be probably limited, as not every test is useful in every situation, and all tests are associated with some level of error.
Mm-hmm. Peter, you interviewed amateur athletes who used Inside Tracker tests. What were they using their tests for?
A lot of them were trying to figure out when they were overtraining or something. I actually talked to one woman who's an endurance athlete, and she was taking ibuprofen, I believe, to treat a bum hip. And she sort of knew that she was taking too much ibuprofen, but when she saw the numbers, she was like, "Whoa, this is just really not good for my liver." So she sort of changed. So she already knew that she was engaging in problematic sort of drug taking, but seeing the numbers was sort of something that made her actually want to change that behavior.
When you went to medical experts to talk about the data that you received, you're laughing about this.
Yes, yes, yes.
Were they laughing at you?
Yes, they were. They were trying to persuade me not to take these tests, or if I did take the test, to basically ignore the results. They don't fall prey to actionability, they were saying. You know, just be very careful about doing something to change these numbers.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Heyman, do you agree?
Yeah, so it's interesting. A lot of people are critical of this area because, especially in this case, this particular case, like Inside Tracker, you wonder what is the real evidence behind this. The premise that earlier detection can be detected by more testing, it seems to make sense. But the problem is that there's actually a lack of evidence to show that that's the case. And there can also be situations where this backfires and that more testing can actually lead to other things that are unnecessary and can cost more, lead people to angst, unnecessary angst, et cetera.
So if you go on, for instance,
on the Inside Tracker website, there's a tab for science. And if you look at that, it's essentially an infographic, right? There's a lot of numbers there, large numbers, things representing thousands of things. But when you actually really try to look at what is the evidence behind these panels, et cetera, it really doesn't seem to be there. Versus if you'd go to something at a clinical laboratory, large laboratory, for instance, the Mayo Clinic, all of the tests have a tab for the utility of that test, and the evidence provided is scientific literature citations and things like professional medical society recommendations.
So what harm could be done by taking these tests and getting the results? Did you feel that you had any problem with them, Peter?
No, I mean, I went in with a very skeptical mindset, and I was not pursuing as many interventions as maybe were recommended. But one of the things that my vitamin D levels were fairly low, and so they said basically, I actually talked to someone at Inside Tracker who was saying, like, your levels are so low that you're not going to, like, get out of that without taking supplements. And supplements were not something I really wanted to take. But and the other sort of problem with taking supplements is that, first of all, there's all sorts of disagreements about what proper vitamin D levels are. And secondly, if you're taking supplements on a regular basis, that means you just need to take more tests. So you aren't overdoing it, right?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Hammond, do you think this is the future, though? You know, maybe apps on your cell phone, things like that, that you can don't even have to send the blood in somewhere.
Certainly there's a place for it, and I think you're right. There are more and more technologies that are coming available that allow mobile devices to perform testing. The question will be, how accurate are these things, and how reliable are they? But we can't ignore it. It's here, and I think it definitely has some promise in certain places.
Mm-hmm. You'd like to have something like that, Peter?
I mean, it was a fun exercise to do. And one of the interesting things earlier, you were saying that there isn't any sort of long-term evidence for doing this. If you test your blood biomarkers for years, there's no evidence that actually improves your health over the long term. And as part of this, I was going to the sauna a couple of times, and I realized that there is some evidence for, like, going to a sauna. There is, and there was a commentary on the sauna paper that was saying basically, when somebody comes, this was a doctor saying, if a patient comes to me and says, "Hey, I want to take this medical test," I basically tell them, "No, just forget about it and do something you enjoy, like a sauna." Yeah. So I think that's the kind of advice I would give to anybody. If you enjoy taking blood tests, then do it. And if you enjoy going for a run or doing a sauna, then do that.
No harm, no foul.
Exactly.
But I think there is a point, though, that that there can be harm in blood tests. And in fact, the whole thing is very interesting because in the hospital, so in clinical settings, there's a tremendous effort underway to reduce the amount of tests that we're offering and that patients are getting. Because we know that there are unnecessary things being done. It's wasting money and resources. It's actually, as I said, there are a number of false positives and negatives that can happen with certain tests. And depending on the way they're used, those percentages can ramp up quite quickly. And so there can be harm. So I think that there is this idea that it's just a test. What can the harm be done? But there can actually be harm done in certain cases.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Theranos had just had to shut down their clinical operations. Do you think we should be putting more restrictions, regulations on new medical startups like that?
So that's an interesting question, because certainly in our laboratories, we also we are able to develop new tests and leverage new technologies using this quote-unquote loophole that Theranos used, which was this lab-developed test regulation. So I think that there is a place for modernizing that, but it needs to be done very carefully so that it does not stifle our innovation. But it also needs to be balanced with the fact that people are doing things that are inappropriate and putting patients at harm.
Peter, would you try any other tests? You're thinking about any other one?
Well, I personally don't enjoy getting my blood drawn, so I probably won't continue to do this. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't rule it out. Especially as it gets easier. I mean, this is sort of like hailing a cab or taking an Uber at this point. It's like very easy to do, and the results are very quick. So I think as those things become quicker and easier, I think as the barrier to access is lowered, you know, I think might be something I'd consider again.
I saw an announcement coming out next week with a telomere test to see how old supposedly from the telomeres on your chromosomes are. So new ones popping up all the time. We'll keep track of them. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Shannon Hayman, Associate Professor of Pathology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Peter Smith, science writer and contributor to Outside Magazine. Well, thank you both, as I say, for taking time to be with us. We're going to take a break. You're welcome. We're going to talk about a type of bull that lost its horns through gene editing. How can biotech be used for animal welfare? And how should it, we keep an eye on and keep track of what's going on there? We'll talk about that right after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. If you've been to a dairy farm, you might have noticed something that all the cows have in common, and I'm not talking about the mooing or the cud chewing. Each cow is hornless, but they weren't born that way. The horns are often physically removed so they don't hurt one another or the farm workers. In case you're wondering, both female and male cows of this Holstein breed are born with horns. As you can imagine, horn removal is not a pleasant experience. Well, researchers at the University of California, Davis, UC Davis, tackled this problem, came up with a novel way to remove the horns without actually cutting them off. Instead, they prevented them from growing in the first place by using gene editing. They swapped a gene from a naturally hornless breed, inserted it into the genome of dairy bulls. Is this a new type of cow or a bull, or did the scientists speed up the breeding process that could have happened naturally? And how should these biotech methods be regulated when it comes to agriculture and food? Has this bull now become GMO, a genetically modified animal, with all the controversy that label carries with it? My guests are about to talk about this. Allison Ininem is an animal geneticist and one of those researchers from the University of California, Davis. And Jennifer Kuzma is a distinguished professor of social sciences and the coordinator of the Genetic Engineering and Society Center at North Carolina State University. That's in Raleigh. Welcome both to Science Friday.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Allison, tell us what you did here. You used a technique called TALENs. Is that similar to CRISPR that we hear about?
Yes, they're both site-directed nucleases, which basically means they're molecular scissors that cut at a specific location in the genome that you tell them to cut at. And so TALENs are kind of a little bit before CRISPRs, but the concept is exactly the same. And what happened with this project, it's actually a collaboration with a company called Recombinetics, is that they targeted the gene that grows horns and basically used the site-directed nucleases to swap out the allele that grows horns in Holstein and replaces it with the allele that stops horns growing in Angus. So it's basically a DNA sequence from a cow at the same location, at the same gene, except in this case, we've now got the Angus allele, and so the Holsteins no longer grow horns.
You know, sometimes there are often unanticipated consequences of doing genetics work. Did you detect any other differences in these,
Actually,
other than they were hornless?
Yeah, they were hornless. We actually sequenced both of the animals because, of course, now we can look at all 3 billion base pairs that make up the bovine genome. And we didn't see any unanticipated off-target effects or anything other than the fact that we had replaced the allele at that one particular location. And really, to me, this is precision breeding as much as anything, so we're able to introduce a desired genetic variant very precisely without affecting any of the other genetics that make them great milk-producing animals.
Do these bulls pass on these traits? I mean, with the next...
Well, that's actually, yeah, so that's our part, that's UC Davis's part of this experiment. So we would hypothesize they would, and of course, being good scientists, we have to actually do the experiment to show that. And so we're collecting semen from the bulls, and it's a dominant trait, and both of these bulls are homozygous, meaning they're carrying two copies of the dominant trait that stops horns growing. And we would anticipate that when we breed them to horned females, that their offspring would inherit this dominant polled allele, and that those offspring would not grow horns, but we'll breed our cows in the fall when it's breeding time at UC Davis, and we'll tell you in 9 months' time.
Do you patent these? Can you patent these cows, these bulls?
Well, that's an interesting question, because what is there to patent? It's just a naturally occurring allele that occurs in beef breeds like Angus, and so I think probably the question that you're asking is, would the technology used to make the change in the bulls themselves be patented? And, of course, that's in the middle of a fairly public debate at the moment, who
yes.
owns rights to gene editing. But really, I think if you look at how genetic improvement is done as it relates for cattle, for example, you buy genetically improved semen from the artificial insemination companies currently, and those improved animals belong to you. They no longer have any reach into the animals. And so I would see this more as probably a value-added trait that would come along with an artificial insemination sire, and so you'd pay a little bit extra for the semen, perhaps, rather than having any kind of patenting associated mm-hmm. with the animal itself.
Jennifer Kuzma, what's your take on this? What are your questions about this technique?
Well, I think the goals of the project are quite noble, to decrease both the animal suffering from the dehorning process, which I can understand would be painful to young cows or calves early on, they're dehorned. So I think in that respect, animal welfare concerns are somewhat decreased. On the other hand, we want to make sure that these products are safe for people who drink the milk, or for if the dairy cows go to beef someday when they get older. We want to make sure that we have a good regulatory system in place in order to ensure the safety of the products coming from these cows.
Mm-hmm. Our number, 844-724-8255, is a number. You also can tweet us at SciFry if you have any questions. Allison, you did this with two bulls, right? Is that right?
Correct.
Isn't that a small n equals two?
Well, these are really prototype animals that we developed, and really what we were looking, we hypothesized that the sequence that's present in the Angus is what makes them polled or not grow horns. But until you actually do that experiment, you really can't tell. And so we have now done that. And so they're actually clones in addition, which makes it not even an N of two, right? And so, of course, we are working to do more animals to look at that. And, in terms of the safety of these animals, there is no foreign DNA in them. So it's a little bit different to traditional kind of genetic engineering or the GMO debate, because really it's just the naturally occurring DNA that's already present in bovine species. So there's no safety concerns associated with eating polled animals. That's basically what an Angus burger is. And we've been eating that particular allele for many years. And I think one thing that's kind of interesting is we've now sequenced a number of cattle, and we find that there's literally millions of variations between the DNA sequence of two bulls from the same breed, for example. And so we're, frequently, or every meal we have, we're eating all of this kind of genetic variation that exists just due to naturally occurring spontaneous evolution and mutations that have occurred over time in the breed.
Yeah, well, you seem to be intimating, I'm just going to infer from this, that you're trying to defend that these animals are not genetically modified in a sense of GMOs,
well,
which you have edited their genes, have you not?
Well, I mean, I think GMO, unfortunately, is kind of an amorphous term that really doesn't mean anything. And so I think specifically, perhaps your question is, are they genetically engineered? And that traditionally has been defined as carrying a recombinant DNA construct. So, for example, the BT protein in insect-protected crops. In this case, there is no recombinant DNA construct or in the animals. It's just basically bovine DNA, and it's sequence indistinguishable from the naturally occurring allele that occurs in the Angus.
I understand. Dr. Kuzma, what's your reaction to this?
Well, there's a couple points. I did read that some of the bulls had physiological differences. So, during the cloning process, they may have introduced some very pronounced physiological differences. So I'd like to hear from Allison what they saw when they looked at the bulls, if there were any morphological changes. And then the second thing is that you're taking a gene from an Angus, which you eat beef typically, and you're swapping out the allele in a Holstein, which you drink milk. So I would want to see the milk tested just in case having the hornless allele had anything changed in the milk coming from that hornless cattle. So it is there are some safety concerns, especially with the cloning process. There's a lot of epigenetic effects. It's my understanding these bulls had reduced sperm levels and some problems with the testicles and other anemia, I think I read as well. So there have been some changes to the physiology, in which case I would want to look at the physiology and the biochemistry of the milk. And so, yeah, it's safety, but it's also consumer confidence. I just think because this is the first gene-edited animal that's going to be entering the food supply, that it would be wise to go through a mandatory pre-market approval process and to actually test that milk and to make sure it is substantially the same as milk from other Holstein cows that have their horns.
Dr. Inanam?
Well, of course, they're bulls, so we're going to have a bit of a hard time testing their milk. and so we will be producing offspring.
Further down the road, I understand that bulls don't have milk. Thank you.
I guess, so we kind of have to differentiate the cloning process from the genome editing process. So in this particular case, these bulls were produced using cloning, which is not necessarily how you'd use the technology going forward. As I mentioned, these are kind of prototype animals. And what ideally I think breeders would like to do is edit the next generation. And so really we'd be targeting the edits into the developing embryos of the next generation rather than kind of going back in time and editing animals that already exist on the ground. And so I think there are known epigenetic issues with the cloning process, and that's really not an ideal way that this would get commercialized. It's really these, as I mentioned, are kind of prototype animals. And what we'd like to do is be able to tweak the DNA of the next generation such that they wouldn't actually have to go through that cloning process. And that would kind of remove the concerns related to epigeneticists or epigenetics as it relates to this particular technology.
I can see the dialogue we're having right here. I know that our listeners are having the same thoughts about themselves, about the pros and cons of this. So shouldn't Dr. Kuzma, shouldn't the public opinion be brought into this and when bringing tech?
I would think that we should consult the public on emerging technologies. And that's not to say that everybody votes on whether or not we want this product, but at least to hear the different concerns that people have about whether it's gene-edited cattle, whether they're bulls or cows, or whether it's transgenic fish or what have you. I do think the public should have a voice in decision-making about this. So to combine the science and the safety studies with people's comfort level, given that they are the end users of the product, I think it is important in a society that's somewhat democratic. So I do think that the public's voice is important, not to say that they should be just basing decisions on values, but it should be a combination of sound science, regulatory process, and public values for wanting to have this milk from the future cows tested.
The public is already tweeting us, letting us know what. Here's an interesting. And this is a typical question we get every time we talk about something with animals. That Scott Hansen wants to know: could this genetic modification technique have use in humans, such as in cystic fibrosis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. That's a good candidate for gene editing is cystic fibrosis, which you can pinpoint an allele. So gene therapy, there has been work done in the lab, you know, looking at gene editing in humans. There's been a lot of public discussion about whether that should be done at the embryo level. And the National Academy of Sciences had a meeting about that last December. And so I think the consensus is to sort of wait on it for embryo modification, but perhaps through gene therapy of targeting to certain tissues, it could be a very useful process in humans. But there you have the medical patient is bearing both the risk and the benefit, so it's a more equitable and just kind of process, so that patient can make an informed decision about whether or not he or she wants to be edited through gene therapy or what have you. With food, it's a little bit different because the consumer is kind of sometimes removed from the benefit. And so however low the risk is, the consumer is still going to see that risk mm-hmm. is pretty high if there's no benefit. So mm-hmm. I think that's the difference between medical applications and food applications. There's a different risk-benefit profile usually with these products.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Plato, talking with Jennifer Kuzma and Allison Inenam. We're talking about new research in creating a bull using some genetic engineering techniques that doesn't have a horn. It's hornless. Are there simple, I mean, I'm going to call it simple because there's only one allele, one little piece of the genome we're talking about. Are there simple modifications we could make where you'd look into for animals that might be improved?
There are already a couple of examples out there. So, for example, the University of Missouri has done an edit that basically inactivates the protein that is the target of a virus that causes a thing called PRRS, or porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome virus, that costs about $600 million annually for the pork industry in the United States. And basically, by inactivating that particular gene, by tweaking the DNA and turning it off, they've removed the target where the virus actually binds, and so those pigs are no longer susceptible to that virus. So I think for me, disease resistance is a really important trait where we could actually use this technology. And to the risk-benefit evaluation, I think in this case, and perhaps the horned one as well, there's very obvious benefits to the animal in terms of not getting sick or not having horns, and therefore it's a bit of a different discussion, and that's really, I think, something I want to have a discussion with the public around, is understanding that thwarting the technology has consequences too, and to have a robust discussion around both benefits and risks, because I think that there are very clear benefits that could be associated with the use of this technology in agricultural breeding.
Dr. Inenam, where do you take this now? What happens to it? How do you move this forward?
Well, I think there's, you know, one of the big uncertainties, and I think Jennifer alluded to this, is the regulatory around this. So according to the current regulatory regime, the FDA is in charge of regulating genetically engineered animals based on the fact that the recombinant DNA construct is a new animal drug, and that affects the form or function of an animal. In this case, in the couple of examples I've given, there is no recombinant DNA present. And so it's unclear whether the regulations cover these animals, or are they just really precision bred animals that don't have any new novel DNA. And that's basically, the foundation of all our animal breeding programs mm-hmm. working on spontaneous variation. Unclear.
I only have a minute left, but somebody was writing and saying, you know, could you possibly create tuskless elephants or hornless rhinos so that people wouldn't kill them for their... mm-hmm. for their ivory, and that's where I'm going to leave it because, mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of nodding of heads on the other end of the telephone.
Yes. I'm not sure if it's a single gene trait like it is in bovine, but conceptually you could do that and maybe remove that prize from the hunters and help that animal population.
I think we've reached a little compromise here. I want to thank both my guests, Allison Van Inenam, sorry about pronunciation, animal geneticist at the UC Davis, Jennifer Kuzma, distinguished professor of social science and co-director of the Genetic Engineering and Society Center at NC State. North Carolina State University in Raleigh. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about, these new things that you talk into, these new devices that pick up your voice. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you find yourself like I do, dictating into your smartphone? Yeah, I use the dictation feature of my iPhone all the time. You know, you tap that little microphone and it translates my speech to words into a text. But as accurate as the dictation is, I gotta admit, I have never really become great friends with Siri, the built-in digital assistant. And I don't know how many people or many people have, you know, they just a little example. Let me give you an example of how difficult this is. Our producer, Christopher, trying to talk with Siri just a few hours ago.
What time is my appointment on Sunday evening?
You have 4 appointments last Tuesday at 12 a.m.
I said, what time is my appointment on Sunday evening?
You have 4 appointments last Tuesday at 12 a.m.
I'm not asking about Tuesday.
I don't know what you mean by, I'm not asking about Tuesday. How about a web search for it?
And just like with Christopher, that's what happens to me usually. Siri says, I'll search for it on the web. Typical, right? So why not just open the calendar app and save the time if you ask somebody to look at the calendar for you? Forgo the assistance of this not very helpful assistant. Well, I'm not trying to pick on Siri here because all this leads up to the question, what is about the way I talk or about human conversation that makes this such a challenge for artificial intelligence developers? I mean, the tech titans are all developing these assistants. You got Google and Apple and Facebook and Microsoft and Amazon. Who's going to win the prize? Who's going to come out on top? Well, that's what we're going to be talking about. Carolina Milanese is an analyst at Creative Strategies in San Jose, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Justine Cassell, Associate Dean of Technology Strategy and Impact for the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, you're welcome. Carolina, what's your experience using Siri and Alexa? And so am I giving these assistants an undeserved bad rap here?
Well, I'm Italian. I lived in the UK for 17 years, moved to Silicon Valley for 4 years ago. I'm married to a New Yorker, so my accent is not something that Siri is very happy with. So that's, one of the difficulties is definitely how voice, accents, jargon, different, words that we use all the time. And we want to be talking to these digital assistants in the same way that you and I are talking. And a lot of time that is not possible. Now, it has been interesting to see the different approaches that vendors have taken to this. So Alexa has a very detailed list of things that you can ask her, and she's very precise about how you need to ask her things. And if you do it the right way, she's very helpful. But most of us don't want to learn that. We just want to talk to them.
Yeah, we want to, like they do on Star Trek, or they do in 2001 Space Odyssey. You just say a word you ask the computer to do something, and it knows exactly what you're saying. Knows exactly what you want to do. Justine, you agree that it's very difficult to teach these computers to learn how to speak English or Spanish or Italian?
What we're talking about right now is how difficult it is to get them to understand English and English spoken by people with a variety of accents. And that's because there's an entire pipeline that goes into an assistant like this understanding what you say. It has to understand your accent and translate it into text. And then it has to understand the meaning of that text. And then it has to reason about what an appropriate reply is. And then it has to say that appropriate reply in a way that's understandable. And you've given examples, lots of examples, and I have many more, of what's called automatic speech recognition failures. That is not understanding what you're saying. And you also gave an example of it not understanding the meaning, looking up Tuesday when what you meant was Sunday. But you started out the show by saying that it was difficult to be friends with these assistants. And that's what I think is really the crux of the matter, because these assistants are advertised as the future of our interaction with computing in the same way we interact with our human assistants or our human colleagues. And do you think that's the case? Most people don't.
I think you're right. I think that we want actually maybe not to become close friends, but friends enough that we can carry on a conversation and even have context, right?
Yep.
So that when I say, or can you make me a reservation at this restaurant? And then I come back later and I say, did you make the reservation? I don't hear what restaurant, what reservation, so right. It remembers my former conversation.
Right. I heard a great example from Alexa, where someone asked Alexa to set an alarm. And when the alarm went off, the person said, thanks. But Alexa didn't turn off the alarm because she didn't know that thanks meant thanks for turning on the alarm. Now turn off the alarm. Because what we mean is not always contained in what we say.
Right.
And our way of talking to different people changes over time. So the way I talk to you is the way I talk to somebody I just met. Nice to meet you. I'm being fairly polite. As we get to know each other, I may be a little less polite, but that's because I'm a New Yorker, and you're a New Yorker too, so you're going to get it. All three of us are New Yorkers.
Hey,
we'll
now,
pick
wait
up on
a minute
that fast.
Here. Forget about it.
Yeah. Exactly. But Siri or Cortana or M or Alexa, they all talk to us as if it's the first time they've met us. And it's no fun to have a personal assistant mm-hmm. with amnesia. That's not what we want from our assistant. We want them to say, you remember that thing you were looking at online last week? Well, the price has gone down, and we know what trouble you got in last year when you forgot your husband's birthday. So I suggest you look it up today and you buy it now while the price is low.
Right.
That's the kind of not just context, but also the kind of pushy conversation you might expect from someone you've known for a long time. And that's actually what I've been working on, is building in those social smarts as well as linguistics smarts into personal assistance, virtual personal assistance.
Yeah, I know that something called Sarah is that the name of
exactly.
it?
Exactly. And right.
And how does Sarah learn about what the right way to do things is?
Sarah learns, for the moment, Sarah has learned from 60 hours of human-human conversation over the course of 5 weeks. So we put pairs of people together, and we had them do a task together, and we videotaped them. And they did that task for an hour each week. And we looked at the differences between the pairs, but also the differences across weeks. And we found, for example, that teasing went up from week to week. And referring to shared experience went up from week to week. So I might say, remember how we did that last week? Well, let's try that again this week. But positivity and praise went down from week to week. Hmm. And that's the kind of thing that we've built into Sarah, which stands for the Socially Aware Robot Assistant. And we find that people are surprisingly engaged, surprisingly because they themselves are surprised by how engaged they are and by how compelling they find the experience.
Mm-hmm. Carolina, there's a lot of money at stake in getting this right, isn't there?
There is, it's called, a lot of people see this as the next computing platform, is the invisible platform to some extent. Voice is very powerful. But I think there's still a lot of questions there as far, not just the social side as we've just been discussing, but what kind of assistance do we want? I talk about it in Jarvis and Mary Poppins terms. You know, from a family perspective, you see a lot of advertising for Alexa and Google Home, of these things that come in and they are your Mary Poppins in the home and helping out and reminding everybody about things. The reality is that most of them at the moment are associated with just one account. So they know everything about one person in the family. And that's not really, what Mary Poppins does. She needs to know everything about everybody to be able to help the family. And then others like Siri are more suited for a Jarvis experience. So they are my assistant, you know, with what Apple is doing with the AirPods in the having Siri whisper in your ear, like, you know, you've seen the movies for the ambassador, that person behind their shoulders just saying, oh, this is so-and-so you met him 2 years ago. He has a daughter, and that's what he does, right? That's a little bit the idea, but it's unclear how we're going to get there. And for now, I think advertising is way overselling what in general what these assistants do. There's a lot of smart already, but I think, you know, trying to talk about them in that context of, oh, wow, they really are helping out my life and my life is going to be so much easier now, is overselling for now. And it would let consumers down once they try, and then that frustration comes in because he doesn't understand that when you say her, you mean your daughter, your spouse, your friend, and you still need to say who you're referring to. And just every time you speak, starting with Hey Siri or Alexa or Google, that's not natural. I don't keep on saying your name every time I engage with you.
Right. That's that same amnesia that makes us feel as if they've just met us for the first time.
On the other hand, Mary Poppins, to take this analogy a little further, she lived in my house. She was around all the time. She heard my most intimate conversations. She's dealing with the kids. You, for this to become more like Mary Poppins, you have to give up your privacy, don't you?
Haven't you already given up your privacy?
Well, Mary's not moved in yet, but
a lot of other technology has.
I mean, but seriously, to get some, you know, if you don't want to have to, if you don't say Alexa or Siri, that they are listening or watching all the time, right? Even when you're not talking to them, they could be collecting your conversation with someone else.
Right, that's the case. And that's also the case with the emails you write and the text messages you send. And most of the technology today is based on machine learning algorithms that require a tremendous amount of data. And to get that quantity of data, they have to be collecting a lot of what you say. And so in some sense, unless you read the small talk, you may already be giving a lot of your talk to science, so to speak. Rather than giving your body to science, you're giving a lot of details about your life to machine learning.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Carolina Milanese and Justine Cassell about these new digital assistants. So where do we stand? What should we expect to be seeing new and improved stuff coming out soon?
Every day. Absolutely. Yes, this really is. As Carolina said, this is expected to be the computing platform of the future. And really, all the tech giants are trying to compete in this space. They're trying to make it so that while you're driving, for example, your hands are busy, you can be talking to a personal assistant. While you're at home, you can be talking to a personal assistant that will segue into that same personal assistant on another platform in your office. Now, how long it's going to take to achieve that vision is another question.
Now, let me go to the phones. Our number, 844-724-8255. Katie in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Katie.
Hi there. You know, my question is, my husband and I don't use this, but we were over at a friend's house and we were testing the Alexa app. And I think one of the things we noticed is, you know, we found throughout the evening we were frustrated at times. She didn't understand what we were saying. We had to keep repeating ourselves. And what was really fascinating was two things. It's one, we have friends named Alexa. And so we're curious kind of the fact that there's this new service you're working on called Sarah. What is kind of the feedback around using names that are still common in our society today? And my second question is, the fact that these are overwhelmingly female voices and female names, do you think that's creating a new dynamic or bringing back kind of the old school feeling of our assistants tend to be female? Why aren't there more apps with male voices, I guess, is my question.
Yeah. Excellent question. And actually, in an article in the Times earlier this week, I talked about whether we push the boundaries of gender stereotypes or whether we stay within those boundaries. And Sarah, we only called it Sarah and we only made it female because we worked very hard to find an acronym. And socially aware robot assistant was the only one we could come up with. If it had been a male name, it would have been a male looking agent with a male body. But
come on, Bob, big old something. Bob could have been.
I know. I tried really hard. I couldn't find anything. But it is the case that we have that different cultures have different stereotypes, and so Siri in the UK is a male voice.
Hmm. Can you make Alexa be a male voice if you want?
I think you can.
Does that answer your question? Thanks for going, Carolina. How do you react to that?
Well, it's interesting that to start with, the you know, we think, does the assistant need to be personified or not? And I argue that you are creating more of a relationship if it is. And, you know, if I think about when we got Echo, and you can actually call Echo. You don't have to call Echo Alexa if you don't want to. But Alexa, you are personifying this kind of jar-looking thing that you have on your shelf. And when we were setting it up, my 8-year-old asked me, well, what are you doing? I said, well, this is Echo, there's Alexa. And she goes, well, is she like Siri? And she used she. So it was, is she like Siri? And I said, yeah. And then she asked the question, and she got her answer, and she said, well, she's smarter than Siri. Can we keep her? And there was immediately, you know, 5 minutes in, there was that emotional connection that she created with this thing. And I think that's important for consumers to learn to trust the assistant and then engage in that conversation. Now, the female and male, you know, is a whole different conversation. We were watching a program the other day on AI in general, and there was Watson from IBM. And again, my 8-year-old is a blessing as far as tweets and everything else that I can use. Said, well, is it like Alexa, but is a boy?
Yeah. Well, I've got.
So
I have to wrap up because we've run out of time. Maybe we'll call Hal. How about that? Or we don't want to call it Hal. Allison Van and. I want to thank you, Carolyn Milanese from Creative Strategies in San Jose, and Justine Cassell, an Associate Dean of Technology Strategy and Impact for the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. I was going to say that we have a new video with Dr. Van Enneman in our Macroscope video this week. You can watch it on our website at sciencefriday.com/cow. sciencefriday.com/cow with Dr. Van Enneman, our video pick of the week. That's about all the time we have for now. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.